Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
When I walk out my front door, the first thing I see on the horizon is Mount Leinster, dominating the skyline, topped by the RTE mast. But even without the added height of the mast, the mountain is a substantial and impressive sight, soaring above the countryside of South Carlow. The mountain is many things to many people, but to me, it's forever the home of the last Irish wolf. And whenever I think of that animal, I think of the sad and inevitable trail of destruction that followed the Irish wolf through the last 200 years of its existence. As far back as 1584, the then Lord Deputy of Ireland began plotting the downfall of these wild and beautiful creatures. Their days were numbered. He invited a man called Robert Legg to devise a plan to persuade people to help in the destruction of wolves. Over the following 25 years, further legislation was introduced, and the wolf became an unwanted animal in the Irish landscape. By 1614, the price on a wolf's head was £3, making its extinction a financially rewarding business. For the native Irish, the wolf had long been a prey, but there had never been an attempt to wipe out the complete population. It was more a case of live and let live. But for the English in Ireland, the wolf was a threat and a nuisance, particularly in the wake of the Cromwellian Wars. And with the arrival of professional wolf hunters from England and the introduction of a ban on the export of wolfhounds from the country, the killing of wolves became a serious and lucrative business. By 1652, the bounty on wolves had risen to £6 for a female and £5 for a male, and 10 shillings for a cub. Thousands of pounds were paid out in rewards for the destruction of the wolves. By the end of the 17th century, wolves appear to have been extinct in Ulster and were under severe pressure elsewhere. The last record of a wolf kill was on the side of Mount Leinster in 1786, when the animal was hunted and destroyed for killing sheep. Understandable from the farmer's point of view, but that wolf was the last of its kind, and it must have felt an extraordinary and terrifying sense of isolation as its pack grew smaller and smaller and finally disappeared. Wolves are social animals. They live and hunt in groups. And the Irish name for the wolf is Machtiara, son of the countryside. For this last son or daughter of the Irish countryside, there was nowhere left to run. Big as the mountain was, it wasn't big enough to provide a place of concealment from the humans who had decided there wasn't sufficient room for it and them in South County Carlow. For that last of its kind in Ireland, the landscape was nothing more than a place in which to try to hide, a place to chase down a meal, a place to survive for as long as survival was possible. Surviving is not living. Gone were the comfort and support of the pack. Gone was the possibility of breeding. Gone was the companionship of other wolves. And gone was the tradition of 34,000 years. The tradition of the Morrigan taking on the form of a wolf as she struggled with Cú Chulainn. The tradition akin to that of Romulus and Remus that Cormac Mac Áirt was raised by wolves. The tale of the priest who encouraged a talking wolf, a human under a spell as it happened, and was persuaded to give the man's wife, also trapped in wolf form, the last rites before she died. Wolves don't have human sentiment, but like all animals, they have a keen sense of survival and a sense of danger and an intense sense of terror when their lives are threatened. And they also have an understanding of isolation and loneliness. That last wolf, harried and hunted across the flanks of Mount Leinster, must have had some sense that its life was, at the very least, in great and immediate danger. What it didn't know was that it was the last of its race in Ireland. That is something we know, And something that crosses my mind every time I drive or walk the roads and paths that crisscross that great mountain. And when animals call in the night, I can't help but think of that last wolf calling for companionship, for consolation, for survival, for assistance, a call that came too late.
Recently, I was going into a shop on Main Street, Letterkenny, while my husband, Lawrence, sat waiting for me on a pavement bench on the street opposite the shop. It was one of those clear, blue-sky days when the sunshine seemed to lift everyone's spirits as they walked or drove down the town. Before I left the shop, I looked across the street and saw that Lawrence's cousin, Michael, was now sitting beside him on the bench. They were deep in conversation, with hand gestures punctuating their banter. I would say the stories were good, but I didn't want to interrupt their crack, so I stood watching them. And then I couldn't resist. I took a photo of them. I didn't know what they were talking about, or even how true the stories would be. But as I watched them, the past and the present seemed to merge for me. I could see them as teenagers again. The buildings behind them became as I remembered them in the 70s. One became Rosh's shop, where we used to pile in at lunchtime to buy small paper bags of sweets, like cola cubes or strawberry sherbets, or else packets of Eskimo marshmallow snowballs. And then, all of us girls in our brown convent uniforms would head back up to school. Near Rosh's, a coffee place now, was a shop where the boys used to gather. A grocery store with very few groceries, but it did have football game tables. It was where the boys would go to buy single cigarettes out of a packet. If the weather was good, they would sit outside on the front steps. I realise now that was probably why we chose to go to Rosh's, so that we could stroll by afterwards, intensely aware of the boys on the front steps. Up the church lane was the way we walked back to school. And when we'd walk down that lane on Sunday mornings from St. Eunan's Cathedral, we'd meet some of the boys heading up the road. When they met us, the question was always the same: who said Mass? So they would have the answer when they landed home. As I stood watching Lawrence and Michael enjoying their chat, lost in my own memories, a man suddenly approached me and said, "I remember the day your mother passed away." He told me what he remembered of that morning in 1972. And I told him I had been thinking about her all that very day because it would have been her birthday. I know she would have been so pleased to hear that so many years after her passing, she is still remembered by some townspeople. I thanked him and he walked on. I looked back at the two boys on the bench opposite me again. Time was drifting back and forth in my mind. I crossed the street over to them. A car horn beeped and the driver shouted a joking comment at us. Lawrence and Michael's cousin walked down the other side of the street and they called to him to see if he wanted to join them. He laughed, but keeping his sensible business head on him, knew it was safer for him to keep going on his errand. I watched the two boys. Men, really. And I tell them they are like the old fellas, the town characters who used to sit on Main Street and comment about everyone passing by. Michael says, "We're like old O'Brien that used to sit here." And with that, O'Brien's nephew suddenly walks past us in a trickery of time. There in Main Street, the time comes for us to walk on back to our cars again. The sun shines down on us. We bask in the weave of past and present, family and friendship and community. Moments from years ago are remembered, and special memories are still being made.
Once, on a holiday in the west of Ireland, I watched intrigued as a great jet-black rook plucked out several big lumps of grassy soil from the lawn behind the cottage. Then, gathering up torn crusts of stale bread I'd left there earlier, he poked them one by one into the holes he'd made. And with his beak, he systematically replaced the divots, stamping them down with his feet and burying the bread for future retrieval. Rooks are clever creatures, one of the few birds to use tools to help root out food from difficult places. They're large birds, dressed in shiny plumage, with baggy legs that make them look as if they're wearing tatty plus fours. A group of these birds is called a parliament. I'm not sure where the expression bird brain came from, but whoever coined it must never have met the corvid family, to which the rook belongs. Decidedly, the smarty pants of the avian world, scientists rate the intelligence of these creatures to be equal to that of a seven-year-old. The corvid family is represented in Ireland by a septet of crows: choughs, hooded crows, jackdaws, jays, magpies, ravens and rooks, and occasionally a visiting eighth cousin from our neighbouring island, the carrion crow. My vote for the best-dressed crow goes to the chough, or Cag Cus Jarrag, which translates as a red-legged jackdaw. Not content to have scarlet legs and feet, these aerobatic acrobats also have long, curved red beaks. I love to watch them in flight, usually in coastal areas, their glossy black wingtips spreading widely like long fingers as they seem to be showing off, chuffed with themselves, tumbling freely in the rising thermals with magical chee-aw cries. Hooded crows are stylish too, with champagne grey bodies, black heads and wings. But to me, they're the hooligans of the avian world, since the day I saw two of them pluck tiny blackbird fledglings one by one from the nest. I tried to stop them, but the minute my back was turned, the hoodies returned to this tender poultry takeaway. Perhaps this behaviour is what gave rise to the term a murder of crows. Then there are the jackdaws, cheeky boot boys, cocky gurriers that strut around briskly on sturdy black legs, going hippity-hop, jaywalking along both rural and urban ground. Shiny, charcoal-grey birds, they have pale grey eyes with the back of their heads and necks a silvery colour. Jack and Jill daws are known to have a hierarchical structure, a pecking order, you might say, with higher-ranked individuals dominating lower-ranked birds and pair-bonded couples sharing the lower rank. They've a reputation for thievery, picking up and turning over shiny objects they find. Gregarious and noisy, these birds of a feather are collectively known as a clattering of jackdaws. Jays are far more private, often concealing themselves in the treetops of their woodland habitat. So to catch a glimpse of these colourful creatures is a rare privilege. Definitely designer birds, with pinky brown bodies, white rumps and black tails. What is the most stunning part of their costume is a striking blue patch on each wing. Screechod Quilla, or young screamer of the wood. These guys hunt out acorns and other nuts, burying them for their winter larder. They can be rowdy and unruly, frequently harassing other birds, conduct that possibly led to a gathering of them being called a scold of jays. Would you believe me if I told you magpies are collectively a mischief? With their predatory behaviour and threatening ack-ack-ack screech, without doubt they are the birdie mafia. Probably the most identifiable of the crow family, the Snach Brach, has earned quite a reputation as a fortune teller. Think, one for sorrow, two for joy. Rossini immortalised this bird in his opera The Thieving Magpie, where it stole silver objects, a crime that condemned a wrongly accused housemaid to death. Fortunately, her life was spared when the silver was found in a magpie's nest. Legend has it that magpies were the only birds that didn't go into Noah's Ark. Instead, they sat on its roof and swore loudly while the world drowned. And talking about Noah's Ark, the Bible tells us that when the floodwaters began to recede, Noah sent out a raven and two doves to find some dry land. He knew that if they didn't come back, it meant they had sufficient dry land to sustain their needs. I can only hope the raven flew back eventually to fulfil different needs with the only remaining female. Ravens are jet black, unmistakable in flight, with wedge-shaped tail and narrow wings. Their call a deep-voiced "krark," collectively described as an unkindness of ravens. They are considered by some to be harbingers of doom for the reputation of appearing at deaths. In his poem, The Raven, Edgar Allan Poe described the bird as "this ungainly fowl, with grave and stern decorum, only uttering one word, nevermore." So, resourceful, clever creatures, are they merely for the birds? No, I think the corvid family has quite a lot to crow about.
The Revenant. As I found my way back along the trail I'd blazed with notches on a beech or a silver birch, I glimpsed the smoky mane and tail of a horse for which I'd been conducting a search. One notch I'd long since blazed on beech or birch, now the blaze on the chestnut face of the horse for which I'd been conducting a search. It faded then, without a trace, the blaze on that horse's chestnut face, obscured as ash has so often obscured a fire. Then, fading without the slightest trace, would have been my desire to be obscured as ash has so often obscured a fire. My dearest wish, that they might unsee, would have been my heartfelt desire, for the charcoal burners, now pointing at me across a glade. My dearest wish, they might unsee the linen bandage on my arm. For those charcoal burners were now pointing at me with a sense of alarm, having espied the bandage on my arm. Although there's little that's truly clear-cut, there was a marked sense of alarm hanging over the charcoal burner's hut. And though there's little that's truly clear-cut, I was certain I'd glimpsed that horse's mane and tail still hanging over the charcoal burner's hut as I found my way back along the trail.
The May sun is blazing. There are poets everywhere. I meet Aunine outside Strokestown House. She opens the car boot, reaches into a box she's brought direct from the printers, and places a copy of Cypher's 99 into my hands. Oh, I love the blue, I say, running a finger down the list of contributors, flicking through to find where my own poem sits. There's nothing quite like the feel of a new publication with new work in it. Someone rushes by to get bowls for assorted crisps and snacks. We laugh at the glamour of working and publishing. Inside, Elaine Quillenon, sole surviving editor, stands to tell the full house that after 50 years, Cyphers will cease publishing with issue 100. She pauses. It's a fittingly intentional statement. There'll be no drifting or limping along, handovers or restarts. Ireland may have transformed. Literary fashions come and gone, and world orders upended since 1975. But Cyphers, an occasional journal for the arts, has come out twice a year, every year. This unbroken 50-year run makes it, as far as we know, the longest continuous running Irish literary print journal. She concludes, I hope the feeling around it persists, a kind of openness, curiosity and impatience, adding, there are other things I want to fit into my life. Picture Dublin 1975, mid-recession. Little money around, less for artists. When close friends and poets Leland Bardwell, Pierce Hutchinson, Elaine Quillenon and Magdara Woods, the last two a couple, gather to discuss a new venture. Instead of the weekly readings they once ran, they're founding a new literary journal. Its focus will be outward-looking, its feminism a given, and contributors will be paid. Writing to contacts in Ireland and abroad, they solicit work in any language the editors know, including Irish, Italian, French, German, Spanish, Dutch, Catalan and Flemish. Over the years, this internationalism and focus on work in translation is maintained. Leafing through past issues, you'll find features on writing in Arabic, Polish, Russian, Galician and Vietnamese, along with specials from Hispanic, Mediterranean, New Zealand and Zimbabwean poets, and most recently, Languages in Ireland, Poems in Translation. Its cover has remained pretty consistent over time. Fonts and textured backgrounds have been tweaked, with each issue in a different Pantone shade. But its octavo size, 24 by 16 centimetres, and title, Cyphers, above a listing of all contributors remains. This refusal to highlight headliners, speaking to the editor's democratic impulses, and there have been plenty of these, including Seamus Heaney, Paula Meehan, Paul Durkin, Kathleen Maud, Dermot Healy, Rita Ann Higgins, John Banville, Moya Cannon and Dearan na Grifa, alongside visual artists John Minahan and Michael Caine. Early Cyphers published seminal poems like Durkin's Wife Who Smashed Television Gets Jail and more controversial fiction, difficult to place elsewhere at the time, including work by Aduwela Maya Pierce and Leland Bardwell. Poems in Irish were published without translation, signalling that literature in both national languages could exist in the same space for the same readership. Not everybody was happy, though. One hostile critic disparaged Cypher's bizarre eclecticism, while a spurned contributor addressed the editors as dear shits. Arts Council funding has been crucial to Cypher's longevity, but so too the support of the wider literary community. Catherine Kavanagh, Patrick's widow, provided early funding and passed on bookkeeping skills, thus maintaining Cyphers in good shape over the years. Really, though, it was the commitment and friendship of the four editors and the continued priority they gave to poetry that sustained it, just as it sustained them. In 2012, Pierce Hutchinson died aged 84 and Leland Bardwell was hospitalised aged 90. And so, Magdara and Elaine edited Cyphers with administrative support from Aunine na Vrin until Magdara's death in 2018. Elaine has gone on since, helped by contributing and associate editors Joe Woods, Natasha Cuddington and Leon Ni Quillanon. Cypher's launches have been held all over the country and much, much further afield. In recent times, a rhythm has been set. Strokestown Poetry Festival in May and Dublin's Books Upstairs in November. But online, you'll find a poster for a party in Harare launching a 2019 special on contemporary Zimbabwean poets. I still smile at the invite for one held in a Renala school hall, which included the highly unlikely injunction, well, for a Cypher's launch, no stilettos. Struck by Elaine's comment, you have to keep faith with people, I recently scoured my shelves, finding Cypher's 48 where my poems first appeared. Times I felt adrift from my own writing, I'd encounter her at an event. Stay in touch. Send us something. It was a nod. Keep at it. Acceptance of a poem confirmed it was alive, protean, with the last line to send the reader back up through it. On a trip to New Zealand, I gathered work from poets I'd met and admired. Cypher's was the first port of call for this special section. I'm one of many who owe a huge debt to its editors for keeping that faith, as delighted to have a poem in number 100 as 48. Avant-garde, international, publishing more work by gay writers than was the norm, and all without fanfare. Cypher's could well be the grandmother of many of the journals popping up now. And so, this December in Dublin, we'll raise a glass to say goodbye, to toast issue 100 and its OG editor, Elaine Ni Quillanon.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days. I won't forget a single day, believe me. I bless the light. I bless the light that lights on you, believe me.
My journey to settling in Dublin begins in Glasgow, with a sitcom and with Tolstoy. 40 years ago this month, I was looking at options for my university education, in particular as between Edinburgh and Glasgow. Edinburgh was closer to my childhood home, and I visited the university on a glorious autumn day, the Georgian buildings basking in the sunshine. My mother had a friend who taught there, and she gave us a guided tour. The trip to Glasgow was different in every respect. With the rain beating down, as it would do for most of the next 4 years, we got lost on our way to the university, and my mother's car broke down as we arrived. But what struck me then, and what I recall now, was the warmth of the welcome. The people who helped us, with our dodgy directions and our dodgy car, were friendly and funny and kind. And I developed an instinctive affection for the city, which has never left me. So I chose Glasgow over Edinburgh as the destination for my studies, and never regretted my choice. City Lights, a TV comedy set in Glasgow, was inspired by a quote from Tolstoy, to the effect that people are the lights of every city. And that's what I felt ever since that rainy Glasgow day. In the course of a 35-year career, I've lived and worked in some of the world's most beautiful cities, London, Paris, New York, Stockholm, Brussels, and I've met, worked with, and made friends with great people in each of them. But I've never felt as much at home as I have in Dublin. And that's down to the people I've encountered here, the human illumination of which Tolstoy wrote. I've met people right across Ireland, from every county, at all walks of life, and have found everywhere a wonderful sense of humour, warmth, kindness, positivity, musicality and a special sense of community. Ireland and the UK are arguably examples of nations divided by a common language. Until I came here as ambassador, I had no idea, for example, that the meaning of the verb to give out was not just to donate to good causes, but had quite another sense. I was on the receiving end of plenty of giving out over several years, about Brexit in particular. But what struck me and deepened my already growing affection for Ireland was that those doing the giving out, ministers, other politicians, business leaders, journalists, could always compartmentalise, distinguishing between the messenger and the message. They were, or to employ the Irish conditional that I've also grown to love, they would have been sometimes angry, disappointed, even dismayed at what I had to say professionally, but never offered anything other than understanding and consideration to me personally. It's not just language which differentiates, if not divides us. There's an asymmetry too. As I prepared for the job back in 2019, an Irish friend had said to me that the fundamental imbalance in the relationship between the two countries was that British people grew up not knowing enough about Ireland, and Irish people grew up knowing too much about the UK. Now, I'm not sure you can know too much about another country, but it's fair to say that many British people don't know enough about their nearest neighbour. Thus, an important part of my job as ambassador was to explain Ireland to a British audience, as well as explaining Brexit Britain in all its complexity to an Irish one. As part of that, I took part in a debate at the Royal Irish Academy, whose title was intended, I think, to suggest that in the modernisation of Ireland over the last 30 years, some things hadn't changed. It was called "It's All Right to Be Anything Now in Ireland, as long as you're not British." I was happy to challenge that premise with several years of evidence that anti-Britishness was not nearly as much of a thing as the title implied. The ensuing discussion also offered me the opportunity to see that there are divisions in Ireland deeper than any in the British-Irish relationship. A participant in the seminar recalled watching an RTE news report from a pub in Cork on the eve of a World Cup football match between England and Iran, where the national broadcaster was inquiring of the regulars which team would enjoy their support in the game. Each responded along the lines of "Iran, of course." The reporter reached the end of the bar and asked the final drinker, "Surely there's one team against whom you'd support England?" To which the answer came yes, if they were playing Kerry. Since I announced in June my decision to leave the British Foreign Service and settle in Ireland, friends have asked me whether it was a difficult choice to make. I can honestly say that it wasn't. I hugely enjoyed living in the UK and representing my country in three other countries, and in the UN, NATO, and the European Union. But I realise that Ireland is where I feel most at home. As I discovered all those years ago, people are indeed the lights of every city, and for me, they shine brightest right here.
Why do I do just as you say? Why must I just give you your way?
Consolations of Time, in memory of the Beguine mystic Harderwijk of Brabant. What other time can equal this? A letter from a friend, the gathering of hazelnuts, embroidering a vestment. And though in time the needle stitches the patterns of our grief, faith can see the golden threads of love dangling beneath.
This is a poem in which a dog is reflecting on its owner. The title is "A Dog on His Master." As young as I look, I am growing older faster than he. 7 to 1 is the ratio, they tend to say. Whatever the number, I will pass him one day and take the lead the way I do on our walks in the woods. And if this ever manages to cross his mind, it would be the sweetest shadow I have ever cast on snow or grass.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Last Irish Wolf by John McKenna, Storytime by Denise Blake, The Magnificent Seven was by Zoe Devlin, followed by The Revenant, a poem by Paul Muldoon. Cypher's 100 was by Nell Regan. My Journey to Settling in Dublin by Paul Johnston. Consolations of Time, a poem by James Harper. And A Dog on His Master, a poem by Billy Collins. The music was Scarunt na Gumpónach, The Parting of Friends, played by Matt Molloy. Old Friends by Guy Clark, sung by Steve Earle and Emmylou Harris. The Magpie theme tune was by the Spencer Davis Group. Days by Ray Davies, sung by Luke Kelly. From Schubert's Winter Song Cycle, The Hurdy-Gurdy Man, played by Matthew Gee on trombone with Christopher Glynn on piano. It Had to Be You by Frank Sinatra, and The Lark in the Clear Air, played on violin by the late Geraldine O'Grady, whose death was announced this week. We broadcast it in tribute to her. And some new books you may be interested in. The Last Irish Wolf by John McKenna, illustrated by Faye Tucker. It's published by Carlow County Council Libraries with the Harvest Press. James Harper's latest book, A Place Where Ireland is Invisible, Sonnets Inspired by Irish Saints with artworks by Paul O'Culmoyne, is published by Eblana Press. And Dog Show is a new poetry collection by Billy Collins. It's published by Penguin Random House, and Billy Collins was in Ireland recently as a guest of Poetry Ireland. And finally, a reminder that there's a new Sunday Miscellany anthology out, Sunday Miscellany, a selection 2023 to 2025, published by New Island Books. And it's up for an Unpost Irish Book Award. The nomination is in the category the journal.ie Best Irish Published Book. And you can find out more and vote at irishbookawards.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Mary Elizabeth Bruton, and the producer is Sarah Pinchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.